We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus 580. Good morning, I'm Bill Hammack. I'm talking about travel today, but not your normal journeys. I look at places in the world where you can see where scientists first listened to the Big Bang, where Darwin thought about his evolutionary theory, or the actual garage where Hewlett and Packard developed their first oscilloscope and laid the foundation for becoming the computer giant HP. My guest today has written The Geek Atlas, 128 Places Where Science and Technology Come Alive. And it contains places guaranteed to make every geek's heart beat just a little bit faster. I invite you to call with your questions, 333-WILL, if you're in the area or anywhere else in North America. Call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Or if you'd like, send me a question via Twitter at EngineerGuyTwit, all one word, EngineerGuyTwit, or instant message me on any IM system using Bill Engineer Guy. Again, all one word. So let's welcome to Focus 580, John Graham Cumming.
To be here.
John, to organize our thoughts for the first few minutes of this interview, I want to get a flavor of the book by taking a short tour of engineering and science in the world's capital. And I think that will get us started on what your book is about. Now, one of the things that you do really well is you shed light on the most commonly visited tourist sites. For example, in Paris, you recommend for its science and engineering the Eiffel Tower. And could you explain why you do that?
Yes, there's two things which are particularly interesting about the Eiffel Tower and sort of not talked about. Obviously, it's a lovely thing to go and look at. It's right by the Seine. It's a superb tourist attraction. But number one thing is the very shape of the Eiffel Tower. Why is it the shape it is? And it turns out that Gustave Eiffel, who made the tower, actually designed it so that it would successfully resist against the wind in Paris as it was blowing in any direction. Mm-hmm. And he wanted at the same time, for aesthetic reasons, not to have any crossbars diagonally across between the two outer edges. So he designed something that would transmit all the force of the wind down the outside. And essentially that's how you get this curving shape that's the Eiffel Tower. So just looking at the beautiful shape, in some ways it's a natural shape made by the wind. Mm-hmm. And the other thing he did was he decided to make the Eiffel Tower a sort of homage to the engineers and scientists and mathematicians that he thought were great names, particularly, of course, of French science. And at the first level up the Eiffel Tower, if you can imagine how it sort of seems to be in two pieces in some ways, at the first level, all around the edge, there are the names of the many scientists that he thought were wonderful, people like Laplace. And you can see them from the ground, although if you do have a little pair of binoculars with you, it might help because they are a little far up. And for years, that was actually covered up because of the way they painted it. And fairly recently, it's actually been repainted so you can see this original piece of work by Eiffel trying to name names.
So these are actually engraved in it? Is that what it is?
Actually, they're almost embossed in it. They actually mm-hmm. stick out from the metal, but they're quite high up. Mm-hmm. And it's 72 great French scientists and engineers. But the way they were painted just made it very difficult to see, and now they've repainted it to make it easier.
And if I recall correctly, the Eiffel Tower was built actually for a kind of a World Industrial Expo where the French wanted to show their prowess as engineers and being able to work with steel. Do you recall that at all?
Yes, right. So mm-hmm. it was built for the 1889 World's Fair in Paris. And, of course, Eiffel was pretty well-known engineer at that point. He'd built a great many iron structures across France, obviously bridges and things for railways, and obviously built the Statue of Liberty, which is perhaps, you know, second best known thing to the Eiffel Tower. And yes, they wanted to show off things, and the Eiffel Tower at that point was the tallest building in the world. So it was sort of a, wow, look at this, what we can do with iron. We can build this great amazing thing as the entrance to our World's Fair.
Well, to stick with Paris and our world capital tour, it also highlights something that you do extremely well in the book, and actually more commonly, and that is to direct us to obscure places that are really interesting. You suggest in Paris that a traveler walk the meridian. What do you mean by that?
Well, so if you go back into the 19th century and prior to the 19th century, countries had not standardized on this idea of the prime meridian, the 0 degrees of longitude, which now runs through Greenwich in London. Sometimes it's called the Greenwich Meridian. It's really called the prime meridian. So every country had their own meridian. Typically, they'd pick on their capital and say, well, you know, we'll choose a north-south line running through our capital. We'll use that as our 0 degrees. Mm-hmm. And then there was this longitude conference which happened, and everyone bar France and Poland, I believe, agreed to use Greenwich because it's a lot easier if everybody's maps start at the same point. Well, eventually the French came into line with the rest of the world, as did the Poles, and the Greenwich Meridian was created. But the French decided that it would be nice to commemorate the meridian. And the reason they did it was not, you might think, well, they were just being French, you know, and they just wanted to hang on to this. But they had a very good reason, which is the meter was originally defined in terms of the length of the meridian. It was actually defined by saying if you go a quarter of a way around the Earth from the North Pole to the equator, so that distance, passing along the meridian, and you divide it by, I think it must be 10 million, I'd have to remember well, mm-hmm. you get a meter. And so, you know, to commemorate this, in 1994, the French government put in place this sequence of, well, what they did was they commissioned an artist to create some memorial to the meridian, and what he did was he put these brass medallions, which are about the size of a saucer, into the sidewalks and streets of Paris, and it enables you to walk along the old French 0 degrees of longitude mm-hmm. through pretty much everything you want to see in the middle of the center of Paris is along this line. So it's a wonderful way of being very scientific, but also seeing the Eiffel Tower, the Pantheon, mm-hmm. the Jardin de Luxembourg, mm-hmm. the Louvre. It's all along that mm-hmm. line or a short distance off of it.
Are there any statues or other things along that to see that are unique to it?
Well, I mean, the place you really need to start that trip is at the Paris Observatory, mm-hmm. which is where there's a line in the floor, which is, of course, the original 0 degrees. And just outside of it, there's a statue of François Arago. And Arago was head of the Paris Observatory, also was briefly Prime Minister of France. But he did a large amount of the surveying of the distance along the meridian. And actually at the time, so we're going back quite a long way here, he surveyed all the way across France and got the definition of a meter off by only 5 millimeters.
Hmm. And so just to defend the French here a little bit, you can't use any meridian to do this if you're measuring the distance to the North Pole because the Earth's not completely spherical, right? So there some sense in this being the one that actually defines the meter.
Well, there is, although the meter, you know, has changed the definition sure. slightly and is now sure. based on, you know, how fast various things are wobbling and how big some natural things are. But yes, so, you know, it wasn't just any old meridian that was going to give you this line. So you had to go through and follow your way all the way across France into Spain, as Arago did. We went all the way down into the Balearic Islands and got this distance, which is quite an amazing feat, if you ask me.
So
for that, he gets a statue, which you can start your tour of Paris at.
Okay. So let's turn to London then in our short world capital tour. Samuel Johnson once wrote, "A man who is bored of London is bored of life." And your book really shows that this is clearly true when looking for engineering and technology. And you recommend a museum that's dedicated to one of my favorite engineers, the wonderfully named Isambard Kingdom Brunel. Can you tell me a little bit about him and what evidence you saw of his works there?
So there is this funny little museum in London called the Brunel Museum. And if you go to it, it's really a couple of small rooms, and you say to yourself, well, what's this all about? Why is Brunel commemorated here? And the reason is that Isambard Kingdom Brunel and his father, Mark Brunel, worked on a project together, which really is the start of Isambard Kingdom Brunel's career, because he was only 19. They dug a tunnel underneath the Thames, and that tunnel was the first significant tunnel underneath a body of water of any significant size. And it's quite a large tunnel. Today it is used as a railway tunnel as part of the underground system. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, they really invented modern tunneling. So they built this system where the people tunneling do it inside a sort of cage, which is holding the walls up, and they dig out in front of them, and they move the cage along a little bit, and behind them there were bricklayers sticking bricks in to build up the walls. And that had not been done before. Normally what people do is sort of digging holes in the ground, or they were digging down from the earth and then filling in above, which, of course, you can't do under the Thames. So they did that. The other thing they did, which was new, was they had to sink on each side of the river a big hole, a lined hole, as the entrance. The initial one they did was had steps down into it. And for that, what you need to do is build a watertight container, which you call a caisson, and you shove that into the ground. Now, obviously, if you dig down, you have the problem of walls collapsing and all those sorts of problems. And they did something which is now standard practice, which is they built the entire thing above ground, and then they started digging out underneath it and essentially let it sink into the ground. Mm-hmm. So these two amazing bits of engineering, which had not been done before, and they ended up building this thing now called the Thames Tunnel. And at the museum, you can visit the caisson which they dropped into the ground, which in itself is quite an amazing feat of engineering. And from early next year, once the line reopens, because it's currently closed for some maintenance, there are tours that take you through in an underground train that goes at almost walking pace with all the floodlights on, and you can see this incredible construction.
Mm-hmm. And there's a museum that's right next to this. Am I understanding that correctly? Or near
yes,
it?
Basically in the what was the pumping house for pumping water out, because, of course, the Thames is pretty leaky, and there's a lot of clay soil and things like that. What was the pumping house is now a museum which tells you about Brunel, the Brunels, in fact, because all three of them, the father, Mark Brunel, mm-hmm. the son, Isambard Kingdom Brunel, and then another son, all worked on engineering projects.
We might well have a listener out there that's a Brunel fan like I am, and apparently you are. And there's a wonderful book called What is Left of Brunel, which points out all of the places in the UK where the things that he built as a civil engineer are still existing.
Yes, so, I mean, Brunel himself, he's a bit hard to escape in the UK, especially in London, because things like the major railway stations like Paddington, essentially all of the Great Western Railway was put together by Isambard Kingdom Brunel. And there are many examples of his work, which are, you know, a testament to how good cast iron is.
Sure. So this is Bill Hammack, and I'm visiting with author John Graham Cumming, author of The Geek Atlas, 128 Places Where Science and Technology Come Alive. It contains places guaranteed to make every geek's heart beat just a little bit faster. And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL. If you're in the area or anywhere else, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. And, of course, you can also send a question via Twitter at EngineerGuyTwit or send an instant message on any instant messaging system to Bill Engineer Guy, all one word. So in Brussels, to continue our tour, you look at the fascinating Atonium, I guess, building is how you would
Atonium,
say.
Atonium, yeah.
Yes. Well, what is this? Describe how it looks.
Well, this is yet another one of these things built for for an exhibition. This was built for the International Exhibition of 1958. And what it looks like is a gigantic diagram you might have expected of some sort of atom. It's got these big silvered spheres that are connected together by silvered rods, and it looks like it's a crystal of some sort, which in fact it is. It's meant to be a crystal of iron.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything inside this building? Is there a museum, or is it just interesting to look at the building alone?
Actually, you know, the building itself is sort of the most interesting thing just because of the shape of it and the way it's standing up there, because it's actually standing on one point, one corner of a sort of, it's a cubic shape overall, and it's sort of standing on one corner, but like a diamond sort of shape.
Okay.
Inside it, there are quite a lot of things. There is actually an exhibition which talks about what was done there in 1958, so from a historical perspective. And there's actually a restaurant on top, and I believe there's even a little place where people sleep sometimes on school trips and things. But to be honest with you, the most interesting thing is the outside of it, and then go and see Brussels, because it's quite expensive to go inside. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the structure that's interesting, because it tells you about one of the crystalline forms of iron.
And to complete our little mini world tour here, what do you recommend in our own capital, Washington, D.C.?
Well, if you haven't been to the Air and Space Museum, obviously you have to go to the Air and Space Museum because, you know, the superb collection of anything to do with flying from, you know, the very earliest days to going up to the space station and things. Obviously those are essential. The thing that I think is quite overlooked in D.C. from perspective of science is the National Museum of American History.
Hmm.
Which, when you hear its name, you think, oh, there must be paintings of American pioneers and, you know, nothing really scientific in there. But actually, there's a lot of history of U.S. science. So, for example, that's where you'll find a lot of Alexander Graham Bell's telephones. They're in there. And if you're much more modern, that's where you'll find Robert Metcalfe's prototype for Ethernet, the networking standard we all use, is the actual card in there.
Wow.
They've got a lot of mini computers, microcomputers, a whole lot of computing section. Amusingly, they've also got the first computer bug. This is the famous moth that was found by Grace Hopper when she was working on something called the Mark II computer at Harvard. This was in 1947. And she stuck the moth into her notebook with a little note saying, first actual case of bug being found. The moth had messed up the computer. That's in there. And there's many other fascinating things. There's, you know, early CT scanners, things to do with X-rays. Hmm. My favorite thing, actually, is a thing called the Bakelizer.
The Bakelizer.
The Bakelizer. And that's the thing that was used to make Bakelite. So it's just a big container for heating up this nasty mixture of phenol and formaldehyde, which is what you make Bakelite out of. And what Dr. Bakerland had figured out was the exact combination of temperature and pressure you needed to turn that mess into Bakelite itself. And his original Bakelizer, which is looks something out of a sort of mad scientist lab, because it's got this very big screws on it to hold everything down because it's under enormous pressure. That's in there. And, of course, Bakelite is interesting as the first, you know, man-made plastic.
Mm-hmm. Well, the National Museum actually has on its fourth or fifth floor a institute endowed to look at inventions and things. And I wonder if that's the source of a lot of this that that we see there in those exhibits and such.
It may well be. And I think also, I mean, their charter is American history, period. So that's every aspect of it is not just, you know, the opening up of the West and things like that, but also everything that's happened since. So it's a very, very fascinating museum and not to be overlooked if you're not exhausted from the Air and Space Museum.
And which Air and Space Museum do you recommend? There's two now.
Well, there's, I mean, if you're hardcore, you're going to go to both, aren't you? You're going to go out and see, you know, there's the main one and then there's the annex with the big, even bigger things in it. Mm-hmm. So, but of course, the one that's, you know, in central Washington, D.C. is marvelous in itself.
Mm-hmm. So we want to continue looking at places, but I want to emphasize to listeners that this is a real travel guide. It's not just something for an armchair's journey. Each entry contains a section of practical information, you know, like plan to spend at least a half day here or for the Eagle Pub where you can get directions for getting there. So I want to know whether you visited each site or did you have a team that did this? How did you approach that?
I've visited almost all the sites, and I'm actually trying to make up the ones I haven't visited. I actually last week was in Geneva in Switzerland and took a trip to CERN, which I'd put in the book, but I hadn't actually managed to visit.
So CERN is the nuclear research facility.
Absolutely. I mean, people will know it best as the place where the Large Hadron Collider is currently being put back together when they broke it, when they switched it on earlier this year. And it's where there's a lot of, you know, subatomic physics is done. Mm-hmm. But ultimately what happened was I had a job which had me traveling an enormous amount. And over the years, I'd sneaked off on all sorts of side trips to places. And when I got the idea for the book, what had happened was I was just hoping to be able to buy a book like this. And I went on Amazon and thought, somebody must have written a science guidebook around the world. Well, I'll buy, you know, Lonely Planet for Nerds. And it didn't exist. And so I made a list of places I'd been, which was about 70 places, and then I researched from there to get it up to the 128 that are in the book.
So what criteria did you use to choose your sites? I mean, you could have just listed kind of tedious third-rate museums or a tacky plaque, you know, stuck to a wall stating that Professor X has slept here. How did you choose these? What were your criteria?
Well, to be honest, it had to be interesting to me, and that was sort of my criteria, and it had to be visitable. So what it interesting to me meant was there had to be something actually worth seeing there that was scientific in some way. The reason I have a hard time with the blue plaques on the walls is, you know, I live in London. I pass these things all the time that say, you know, the Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston, lived here. And that's interesting, but not really as a destination. It's good if you come across them in a sort of serendipitous way. Mm-hmm. So I avoided things like that, and I avoided museums which were very, very narrow interest. For example, there's a Museum of Thermometers, which I believe is on Cape Cod, which is the sort of thing that sounds like it might make it into the book, but it turns out to just be a whole load of thermometers. So I tried to do that, and I also picked places where I could explain the science behind them as well, because the other half of the book is, it's not just what's there, it's some piece of science that I've tried to explain in two pages, so you don't just get the sort of whitewash brush-over view of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wanted to mention that to readers, that you do a really nice job in, as you said, about two pages of explaining the technical details, the scientific details behind it. And it's part of the thing that makes the books lovely and gives a little extra detail and interest when you're at the sites. So now every reader is going to have their favorites and their own interests, but I want to select some of the sites and show the range of things you cover, though I admit here that some of my own biases are going to come through. So as an engineer, I'm fascinated by infrastructure, and I like to look at it everywhere. My wife and I have been in salt works in a number of places in the world, and old garbage dumps and other things that are tied into technology. And you describe here the cutting edge in power generation in southern Spain. Now, what did you see there?
Oh, you were talking about what's called the Solucar power plant, which is near Seville. Seville is in southwest of Spain, so it gets very sunny there, almost all year round, there's sunshine. And there's a project outside of a little place called Sanlúcar la Mayor, where they're building and have built solar power stations. And the one I put in the book is this thing called the Solucar PS10. It's a 10-megawatt solar power station.
Now, how big is 10 megawatts? That's enough for what? How many homes would you
say? A few thousand homes.
Okay. All right.
So it's powering essentially local towns all by itself.
Okay.
And the way in which it works is, and it looks, I say in the book, I think, that it looks like something out of a James Bond movie. You drive up to this, and there's this tower, a concrete tower, sticking up into the sky, and then what look like white beams of something spraying onto the tower. And actually, those white beams are sunlight being reflected off 600 or so mirrors, which are on the ground, which you'll see in a field. And the air is glowing just because there's a little bit of dust in the air, and there's an intense white light. And on the top of the tower, there's this thing they call the solar receiver, which is actually really a big vat of water, which is being heated up to 257 centigrade and creating steam.
Hmm.
And the steam drives a turbine, which makes electricity.
So this is very different than a photovoltaic effect, is that right?
Yes. Totally different. This is really, a steam engine, and they're using the sun to heat it up.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, many power stations are realistically steam engines. I mean, nuclear power stations just make heat to make steam and so on. So this is that. Near to this thing, there's also a photovoltaic field, which is making about just over one megawatt of electricity. And they're building an even larger version, a 20-megawatt version of the solar, the solar steam generator close by. So there's lots of sort of test projects there, but they are really building, making power and quite efficiently. They're doing about, I believe it's about 17% of the sunlight is being turned into electricity.
Wow. Well, this thing sounds amazing to see. I'm reminded of Lewis Mumford, the great historian of technology's comment that technology allows us to have visual experiences that we could never experience, prior to the Industrial Revolution. Hundreds of things that look identical, and this mirror system sounds a little bit like that.
It's also in an agricultural area, so you sort of drive up to it, you've been going over fields, and suddenly there's this glowing tower in the middle of nowhere, and it looks just like there must be a maniac James Bond villain somewhere nearby.
So another place that you mentioned, and the English word here is going to trip me up, Farnborough Air Sciences Museum.
Now you did a good job of that. We probably say Farnborough.
Okay. Yes.
BRA at the end, but yes.
Well, can you tell me a little bit about this? I mean, what can one see there?
Yeah, this is one of these sort of, in a way, labor of love museums, because Farnborough is a place very much associated with aircraft design in Britain. And there were a lot of wind tunnels and a research institute there. And a lot of that stuff was being knocked down, taken away. And a group of people got together and created this Farnborough Air Sciences Trust, which has a museum, and saving a lot of the equipment. And probably the star exhibit of that is the first jet engine, or at least one of the first jet engines. There's a guy called Sir Frank Whittle who had brought up the idea of the jet engine in prior to the Second World War and had actually patented it. I believe it was in the 1930s in the UK, and he built this jet engine. And there was actually a British plane, a jet plane, very, very early on. And it has all the usual principles of the jet engine. And actually, interestingly enough, there's also an afterburner that he thought up as well and added on the back of it. And they've got one of those. The British often call it afterburner and augmenter. And so that's the star exhibit. The other thing that's rather fascinating in there is there's all the wind tunnel models that were used for testing the shape of Concorde, particularly the low-speed performance of Concorde, because if you remember, Concorde was great at Mark II, yes. But when it got slow, it had to do all sorts of funny angles, and its nose had to bend and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's actually these wooden models that were used there. And the other thing that's rather fun, there's the front half of a 1971 Trident passenger jet, so really the cockpit,
mm-hmm.
Which they've restored to working order, and you can go and see how it also operates, and if you're interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about that aircraft, this is from the early 70s, is it was a very fast passenger plane. It was a Mark 0.88.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very fast. And it had the unique ability, it was one of the first aircraft to do automatic landing.
Hmm.
Now, of course, at Heathrow, because of the amount of fog there is, that's a very common occurrence,
sure.
And obviously the British had to think that up.
Sure. And I love the fact that you've told Frank Whittle's story. I've always felt that his story is just too unknown for the huge impact that he had on our world with the jet engine. And, in fact, in this book, as you noted before, you're very careful not only to mention a site, a location, but to offer a few pages of really excellent background information on the invention or the science. So to demonstrate that, maybe tell me a little bit about the jet engine. I mean, how does one work?
And yeah, jet engines are rather fascinating because they're one of those things that people, you always look at them on planes and you think, oh, that must be incredibly complex. And, of course, there are many, many challenges to how jet engines work. But they're just one of these wonderful examples of Newton's laws in action. And what jet engines are is they are a gas turbine. So basically at the front, you've got a rotating compressor, a whole lot of blades that compress air as they come in. So you compress that air. And in the middle, the compressed air enters a chamber and you get jet fuel injected and burnt. So jet fuel enters, burns in the air that's been compressed, expands, and then starts shooting out the back because that's the direction it's going to go. The first thing it meets is the turbine. So as it rushes through this turbine, the turbine turns, and that turbine is connected to the compressor. So all you've really got is a big rod. On one end, you've got a compressor. On the other end, you've got a turbine.
Mm-hmm.
Turbine, so the whole thing is spinning around. There's very little moving parts. It's not like a car engine, which is all sorts of things moving up and down. And then the hot gases escape out the back through the nozzle, which is the bit we're all familiar with. And what happens there is you just get a reaction. Newton's law, you know, an equal and opposite reaction. Pushing against those turbine blades, the hot air shoots out the back, and of course, you get an equal and opposite force on the plane, and the plane moves forward.
Mm-hmm. And part of the key here is that very few moving parts make these things very reliable.
Absolutely. Absolutely reliable. One of the things that actually fascinated me, which I didn't really talk about in the book when I investigated all this stuff, is how do you keep a jet engine flame alive?
Hmm.
Because if you imagine you've got this burning jet fuel in the middle, but you're rushing along at, you know, maybe 500 miles
sure.
per hour, why doesn't it blow itself out? And the truth of the matter is it would blow itself out. And inside a jet engine, they have these little sort of what they call a flame holder, which is it's a special shape made in the combustion chamber. You can imagine a little cup shape where the air is slowed down by the shape and the flame can be kept alive in that little spot to keep mm-hmm. the whole thing burning.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's truly amazing that the evolution of these things. On the Boeing 777, they were able to get the FAA to approve two engines to go overseas, and they calculated the probability of losing both engines was so remote that you would always have one engine to travel. I mean, these are so reliable now.
Yes, and then you've got, you know, you have to look at the glide slope for those large aircraft, which is they can glide quite a long way.
Sure.
So
sure.
I'm not sure I'd like to test it out. But,
not over an ocean. But so in your book, you uncover some of the most fascinating science museums that I just have never heard of. In Las Vegas, you came across the Atomic Testing Museum. I mean, what could one of our listeners see at such a museum?
Well, what you really get to see there is you get to look at the history of atomic testing. So the important thing to realize is that Nevada is the site of the greatest number of nuclear explosions anywhere. There's outside of Las Vegas, there's a thing called the Nevada Test Site, which you can actually go and visit if you arrange it long enough in advance, where over 1,000 nuclear bombs were set off. So between 1951 and 1992, in this enormous area, thousands of square miles of lake beds. Initially, above-ground explosions were done, and then below-ground explosions were done. Now, of course, if you can't go and visit the actual site because you haven't got time, you haven't organized it, they have this atomic testing museum which explains the technology behind setting off nuclear bombs essentially safely in the desert. So how you dig them into the ground, how you observe them, what happens, you know, in measuring the radiation and the seismic motion of the land, etc. And they also have, and this is Las Vegas, of course, a ride, if you like. And the ride is, I believe it's called the Ground Zero Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And they take you back to the 50s where people were observing above ground tests. And they put you into one of the bunkers where people were actually situated, concrete bunker, and you have this little slit of a window. And you look through the slit of the window and they set off a nuclear explosion. So there's this almighty flash of light. Then you see in the distance the mushroom cloud, and as it goes through all of its different colors and shapes, the whole theater moves because it's on a rams to give you the shaking feeling, and then there's a hot rush of air comes in through the slots. So the idea is to give you the experience of being, without the radiation, an American serviceman who was sent out to observe these things.
So you're listening to Focus 580. Today's subject is travel, but not everyday travel. Instead, we focus on places around the globe where science and technology come alive. I'm talking with John Graham Cumming, author of The Geek Atlas, and I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area or anywhere else. Call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455. And 800-222-9455, or send questions via the internet, Engineer Guy Twit for Twitter, or any instant message system, Bill Engineer Guy, all one word. So in your travels, it's obvious that you've visited many science museums. What is the state of science museums today?
Well, I suppose some of them are absolutely marvelous. My biggest worry about science museums is when they go for the IMAX experience, a sort of an excuse for, we have to go wow, so we'll have one of these, you know, an IMAX or even a 3D IMAX theater, and we'll put a lot of effort into that. And clearly those things are probably money spinners for museums, but I tend to like actual explanations of what things are. So, you know, if I could do things, it would be to try and explain a bit of science, which is sort of what I did in the book, and I wish science museums would do that better.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the best one I've been to in terms of, if you're a hardcore scientist, is the Deutsches Museum in Munich in Germany.
Now, I have to interrupt you. I was going to ask a question on that. I want you to know that the first day of my honeymoon was spent there with my lovely engineer wife. And
that sounds like a fantastic idea.
It is the greatest engineering museum, science museum, and so why don't you just extol the glories of that beautiful museum?
The thing about the Deutsches Museum is the reason I wrote this book. I was actually working in Munich temporarily. And bored, I asked, you know, the tourist office, what could I go and see? And they said, well, have you been to the Deutsches Museum? Because I didn't realize it was probably the most famous thing in Munich. And I went there, and of course, then I had I questioned myself about why I'd never heard of it, and hence the reason for looking for a book about scientific places. Deutsches Museum is a simply enormous science museum with a collection, such a rich collection of things, that is one of those places I think you could go back and back and back and see something different. For example, they have a section which they call power generation.
Mm-hmm.
And the power generation collection starts with an example of a wheel driven by a dog that would be used by a blacksmith. So the dog is running around in a circle, pumping air into the fire to keep the fire warm. And you can imagine it sort of works its way up there to the different shapes of turbines used in hydroelectric plants. And the most amazing thing is a lot of this stuff is actually running. So there are water wheels in there with water pouring over them, showing you how they operated. It's just such a rich and fantastic collection. And there are two annexes with aircraft and ships and all sorts of things like that. So, you know, if you go to Munich, obviously lots of lovely cultural sites, but also the Deutsches Museum is an absolute must-see.
You know, that's interesting, your approach to it. My wife and I had the same approach. Munich was a way station. We had landed there to head over to Vienna and elsewhere. And somebody said, you ought to visit that. And we walked through the door and were completely stunned. I mean, it's 50,000 square meters, 28,000 objects, and many of the things you mentioned are actual real-sized and the real thing.
Yes, I mean, for example, there's another thing where you walk in and they have a room full of boats where they're you know, showing you, well, this is what a canal boat used in Holland looked like, and there it is. And they've actually sliced through the side of it so you can see what it was like below deck. So, you know, I can't speak more highly of the Deutsches Museum.
Well, neither can I.
If it's a sunny day in Munich, there's also a human-powered sundial outside where you stand in the right spot and your shadow tells you the time. I mean, it's simply marvelous.
Now, of course, in this book, you move well beyond just science museums, and you locate things in the landscape that one can see and appreciate. And we touched on that a little bit with the Meridian. But one of my favorites is I believe it's called the Falkirk Wheel near Glasgow. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. So in Britain, as in, you know, many countries, there's an important network of canals, obviously used during the Industrial Revolution. But many of them fell into sort of disuse and, you know, became just for tourism. Well, in Scotland, there are two canals, one which essentially starts in Edinburgh and heads off westward, and the other one, which is called the Forth and Clyde Canal, which starts outside Glasgow and roughly goes eastwards. These two things met near a place called Falkirk. And originally, there's a big drop between the two. There's about 35 meters of distance between the two. And originally, there was a flight of locks, 11 locks over 1.5 kilometers. Well, those locks got dismantled, fell into disrepair, and basically the link was broken. Well, in 2002, there was a decision to link these two things back together again, these two canals. And the way to do it was to remove all the locks and build a boat lift. And there are other examples of boat lifts around Britain and Europe. And what they built in Falkirk was essentially a large wheel with two watertight containers in it. And you can imagine they're at opposite sides of the wheel. So one is connected to the canal at the top and one of the canal at the bottom. Boats enter each one of those caissons, again, a watertight box. And then the wheel turns very slowly, lifting one boat up to the top canal and dropping the other one down to the other side. And a simple set of cogs keeps everything level as it's turning. And so that was opened in 2002, and now those waterways are completely open.
Hmm. So you, in this book, listed a lot of places. I travel a great deal, and you listed places that I just had never heard of before. A completely unknown place to me was the Voltaic Pile in Lake Como, I believe it is, in Italy. What happened there? What is this?
Well, of course, Volta, the man from whom we get the vault, was a friend of this man called Galvani, who we get galvanic current, those sort of terms from. And Volta is the person who really invented the battery. Prior to Volta, you had things like Leyden jars, which you had to charge up. Famously, of course, Benjamin Franklin with his kite in the storm, charging them up. And what Galvani was doing was he was interested in why there seemed to be electric current coming from frogs' legs. And what happened was Volta figured out that, no, he didn't need a frog's leg. What he could do is he could pile up disks of different sorts of metal and soak the whole lot in brine, and he could get a current out of it. And this Voltaic Pile was really very, very important because going forward, you could now make electricity fairly easily. You don't have to charge things up. You just got the right, you know, silver and zinc disks and a whole load of brine or sulfuric acid or some other thing. And essentially, you've got a lead acid battery.
Mm-hmm. And you can actually see this. You can actually see.
Right. Well, the Italians, what they did, so Volta was from Como, which is on the edge of Lake Como, an absolutely beautiful location. And right on the edge of the lake, they built this thing called Tempio Voltiano, a temple to Volta. In a completely over-the-top Italian way, it's this gigantic temple. It contains paintings of Volta meeting Napoleon and things like that. But it also contains all of his equipment, including some of the original Voltaic piles that he created.
Wow. This is Bill Hammack, and I'm visiting with author John Graham Cumming. We're talking about places you can visit where science and technology come alive. Call with your questions, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Send a question via Twitter, Engineer Guy Twit, or via instant message, Bill Engineer Guy, all one word. Now, with anyone with the least bit of geek in them loves the images created by M.C. Escher. And no engineer's dorm room is complete without one on the wall. So did you come across his work anywhere in your travels?
Absolutely. There is an entire museum of Escher.
Was that right?
The Escher Museum in The Hague in the Netherlands. which has got most of the original works that you're so familiar with, you know, the hands drawing your hands and those monks that climb up a staircase that goes round and round and round forever. So that is, you know, if you're into Escher, they have wonderful information in English there, and, you know, it's right in The Hague. So, yes, wonderful place.
Hmm. And I believe, isn't there a room where you can actually photograph yourself as in an Escher drawing or something? Is that
well,
right?
What there is a room where what you need is you need to go with a friend, and ideally a friend of equal height to you or similar height to you. And there's a room with an illusion in it where the two of you stand in different corners and they take a picture of you. And then when you take a look at the picture, your friend will, or you will appear much different height. To the one. Like one of you is tiny, one of you is gigantic. Because of the clever way in which the walls are painted, so your brain is fooled by the information.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and take a caller. So, caller on line one from Urbana, please go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering if the book indicates whether or not the descriptions that go with the exhibits in some of these European museums are in English. And I seem to remember being in... a large museum in Munich, might be the one you referred to, or it could have been one on technology. And there were a few English-worded descriptions, but most everything was in German. So if you could answer that, please.
Very interesting question. I'm sure that was the Deutsche Museum, would be my guess from the description. John, what are your comments on that?
So what I tried to do in the book was indicate when there was good information in English and when there wasn't. So in some cases, it was the case that there'd be an audio tour that was in English or signs that were in English. For example, the big science museum in Paris, they've got a lot of information that's in French and in English. But I think, and I'd have to go and look at my own book to check this, that the Deutsches Museum is mostly in German, and you have to either get the audio tour or a guidebook, I think, that's in English. So I did try to do that for the European museums. And to be honest with you, most of the large ones now have pretty good information in English, but it was a concern.
Interesting. So now, of course, in the book, you a lot of times celebrate science and engineering, and reasonably so, but it's not completely a hymn. I was fascinated at your suggestion to visit the Chernobyl exclusion zone in Ukraine. What can you see there? I mean, can you actually go there?
Yes. So what you can do is you can go to Kiev, capital of Ukraine, and there is a national museum of Ukraine there, which has a big area about what happened in Chernobyl. And so there's lots of artifacts taken out of the exclusion zone, a very detailed description of what actually occurred. So that already is one thing you can do. If you book it ahead with a guide, and you do have to have a guide, you can visit the Chernobyl exclusion zone. So the area around the reactor, which is now no longer operating. Many people don't realize, actually, they had operated for years after the explosion. The other reactor is now almost devoid of human life. There are some people who've moved back into that area. It's about a 30-kilometer circle around the reactor. Originally, there were about 350,000 people in that zone. Now there's a handful. But you can go in and you can get quite close to the sarcophagus they've built around the reactor. You do need to go with somebody who knows where you shouldn't go because bits are radioactive.
Do you think this is safe to do?
Well, it's not something. It's not like an unofficial tour. It really is quite well organized to go around there. And typically, you'll have somebody with you who is taking radiation readings, and they're very careful. I mean, there are bits of equipment, for example. There are helicopters and things that were used to fight the actual fire,
right.
which are just abandoned in there, and you can't go clambering around on them because they got seriously irradiated.
Very interesting.
But you can go and visit the town of Pripyat, which was the town that's very close to the reactor. That is an old experience because life basically stopped on that day. So you have this, 1986, let's just stop life. And so there's the school and all the books in the school and the library. And they were actually preparing for a parade, a Soviet parade. And in one area, there are banners and things that were ready to be unfurled in the streets.
Now, John, in a typical travel guide, you might see 100 or 125 places or something. And I think you played a sly little trick on this. Why precisely 128 places to visit?
Yeah, that's sort of a secret message to see if you're really a geek or not when you pick up the book. I'm a computer person, and, of course, computer people are obsessed with binary and therefore powers of two, like 2, 4, 8, 16. Well, 128 is a power of two. And when I was doing the book, I really wanted to, I was either going to do 64 or I was going to do 2 to the 7, which is 128. So it's a bit like saying, you know, 101 places or 100 places to someone who likes decimal.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, 1000000 in binary. So
right.
That's very, very nerdy.
So let's take a look a little bit then at the cultural aspects of this 128. For the most part, they're divided equally between sites in Europe and the U.S. and a few in the Far East and Russia, which I hope we'll get to. I guess we got to Chernobyl. But Africa, for some reason, seems to be left out. Did incorporating this part of the world present difficulties, or is this representative of the history of engineering and science?
Well, it presented difficulty for me in terms of finding places that were interesting to visit, visitable, with something left to see. I mean, I think the obvious place that's missing is things that are in Egypt. And I'm actually hoping to do a Geek Atlas 2 and expand out into both Africa and actually into the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we go back into, you know, beginnings of mathematics and beginnings of engineering, there's a lot in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Well, to move just a little bit further afield, outside of kind of the Western world, you recommend traveling to India, and you say to people that they should see an enormous stone observatory. I mean, why was this built? What does it do?
Well, it's an observatory. It's built for examining the movements of the moon, the sun, the stars. Mm-hmm. And so this is the Jantar Mantar you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Which there's two, actually. There's one that's in Delhi, and there's one that's in Jaipur. And the one I specifically was mentioning, the one in Jaipur, just because it's been restored to an incredibly good state. It was built in the 1700s. It is absolutely enormous scale. I mean, the biggest thing there is a sundial, and the sundial's gnome on the thing that sticks up is 27 meters high.
So wait a second. The part of the sundial that sticks out is 90 feet or so. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So, and the idea of that was it could tell, because it's very tall, there's a very long shadow, and you could then make very, very accurate readings. And in fact, the accuracy is about 2 seconds.
Really?
So the idea was that you could then go and make these incredibly, you know, accurate time measurements, star movements, etc., partly for religious purposes, because you might want to accurately time your religious festival based on that, but also just to understand the calendar in general.
Hmm. Now, one thing you note about this sundial is that it can tell the time both during the day and night. How is this different than a regular sundial then?
Well, obviously, a sundial usually uses the sun.
Mm-hmm.
The nighttime ones, there are a couple of things you can do. One is star observations with it, because surrounding it, there's a whole load of other stone equipment for doing that. And the other one is actually by looking at the movement of the moon as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, the entire place, there's not just a sundial, there's many other gigantic stone constructions. Some of them, for example, you can stand in them and take a sighting of a star, and then you can measure the star's declination directly off it and find out what star it is, depending on what time of year it is.
Mm-hmm.
Well worth actually Googling the Jantar Mantar just to look at the pictures of it, because it is a strikingly beautiful piece of equipment.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to spell Jantar Mantar, J-A-N-T-A-R space M-A-N-T-A-R, because I'm the kind of person that would listen when I Google that and could not spell it. So, John, now I want to take you to task ever so slightly, and very slightly, about your title. I'm an engineer, and many of your places, in fact, most of them, are the achievements of engineers, and yet we only make it in the title as the kind of sterile word technology. Did you consider putting engineering in the title? Was there any resistance to this?
There wasn't any resistance to it. The title actually wasn't my original title. I had a different title playing on that book, you know, 1001 Places to See Before You Die.
Mm-hmm. I have
my original title was going to be 128 Geeky Places to See Before You Die.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think the publisher wanted to try and make it a bit more obvious to the person who's wandering by what the book was about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to take the take you to task, I mean, there's lots of mathematics as well, and I'm a mathematician, and there's no
fair.
Mathematics in the title. So.
That is fair. And I think your publisher did you a service to replace that title and add the one, 128 Places Where Science and Technology Come Alive. It's very, very descriptive. So I'm sure that it's hard to choose a favorite site, but if you could narrow it down a bit, is there any place or places listed in the book that just, I'll say, warm the cockles of your heart? Any place like that?
Well, I think there's a place that always amuses me whenever I think about it, which is Experimental Breeder Reactor 1 outside of Arco, Idaho.
Hmm.
And that's the first breeder reactor ever, the first nuclear reactor to make electricity to power a town, light bulbs. And the reason it always makes me smile is in the parking lot, there are two nuclear aircraft engines. In the 1950s, the U.S. had a plan to put nuclear reactors on aircraft and turn jet engines, use them to heat up the air in jet engines. And they built these two prototypes, and I think they're sort of a monument to engineering, folly, the 1950s, the Cold War, everything all in one. So, and they're simply massive as well. You can't quite imagine the aircraft they were going to go in. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
It's been lovely talking to you. Thanks very much.
Wonderful. I'm Bill Hammack, and I was talking with John Graham Cumming, author of The Geek Atlas, 128 Places Where Science and Technology Come Alive.